Early voting gets underway tomorrow across the state, and Iowa's law is unique in that it allows anyone who gets the signatures of 100 county voters to choose a specific voting place in that county. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Wednesday, 6 weeks out from Election Day. We have a lot to talk about. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah McCammon will update us on the presidential candidates' ground games in the state. Political scientists Lindsey Kahn and Tim Hagel are here to give us an update on the latest domestic and international politics. And we'll hear from an Urbandale newlywed whose nuptials earlier this month were thrown for a curve when the president showed up. Politics Day starts right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday, welcome. And to join us for this hour with analysis, Lindsey Kahn is with us, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Lindsey, welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
Tim Hagel with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Tim, welcome to you.
Hey there.
We want to get analysis from you, of course, but a little bit later. We want to check in, first of all, with Iowa Public Radio's Sarah McCammon, Iowa Public Radio reporter and, of course, Morning Edition host. Sarah in Des Moines, welcome to you.
Hi, Ben.
How are you doing today?
All right. How are you?
I don't know about you, but I saw 6 weeks from the election, and I think the intensity of the campaign leads me to believe it could be next week. What about you?
Well, in a way, it is this week. You know, early voting starts on tomorrow, Thursday.
Yes, yes.
And we're the first swing state that has that opportunity. It's something both campaigns are talking about. I would say generally that the Democrats are pushing it a bit harder. But yeah, I mean, we're really almost in election season now in many ways.
Yes, and you're covering the so-called ground game of both campaigns out there around the state. What can you tell us?
Well, you know, I checked in with both campaigns yesterday, and it's interesting. They're both saying that they have really unprecedented ground games that they've built on what they did 4 years ago, of course, with Romney running in the primary season and Obama as the nominee 4 years ago. You know, I spoke, first of all, with Tom Sold. He's the communications spokesman for the Republican National Committee here in Iowa.
We have an unprecedented ground game here in Iowa. We're talking to more voters than we ever had before. And, you know, after 4 years of failed policies from the president, we feel that that's the most important thing to do.
But if you talk to Democrats like Erin Seidler, the communications director for the Obama campaign here in Iowa, she says, you know, we're also way ahead of where we were last year. She told me they have about 47,000 more absentee ballot requests from Democrats than in 2008, and that they've also built on their grassroots effort.
You know, we've been building an organization here since 2009. We have volunteers in every county, and we're really and I think we're really seeing the strength of our ground game pay off.
So both campaigns really insist that the ground game is key.
One difference, I wonder if you found this, would it be fair to say that the Obama campaign has had a grassroots effort up and running continuously since 2008?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm not sure how much was going on in like 2009, 2010, you know, in between elections. But I do know that they've been organizing even since before the caucuses, when all the attention was, of course, on the Republicans who were trying to pick a nominee. The Obama campaign was having house parties and getting people together even before January. They have 67 field offices throughout the state. The Romney campaign has 13. It's hard to know how much of an impact those make. Some of those are very small offices. But, you know, those are how those numbers break down. Of course, the Romney campaign says that they've made many more phone calls and voter contacts this year than the Republicans had at the same point 4 years ago. They just made their millionth voter contact, either email or phone call or mail in Iowa, they say. So, you know, again, both are really emphasizing we're getting out talking to voters.
As you mentioned, Sarah, early voting starting here in Iowa tomorrow. Before this month is out, before September is out, 30 states will be voting. Interesting to see that when Election Day dawns, more than 45 million Americans expected to have already voted. That is a record number. What are you hearing from the campaigns about how early voting may be impacting the campaign strategies?
Well, again, both say it's important. It is something that Democrats seem to emphasize a bit more. When President Obama spoke at Living History Farms in Urbandale at the beginning of the month, you know, he specifically mentioned it. Erin Seidler, the spokesperson for the campaign here, you know, she says there's so many things that can happen on Election Day. We really want our voters, you know, whether they're working or busy with kids, we want them to get out and vote now. The Romney folks say it's not something they're ignoring, but their strategy is generally to wait a little bit longer. They feel that, you know, attrition can happen. If you get people out early, they may forget. If you tell them about early voting too early, they may not take advantage of it. So they've started sending out mailings this week promoting early voting. Republicans do have, or rather Democrats do have a big lead in the number of people who have requested absentee ballots by mail. But then again, Republicans have a lead in actual active voter registration. So it really depends on which set of numbers you look at.
Mm-hmm. There have been recent polls ever more favorable to the president. Looking at Nate Silver of The New York Times this morning, he's the one who scientifically crunches all the polls. He has 48% polling for Obama in Iowa. He has placed Iowa in the lean Obama column. With a 74% chance of winning the state as of today. Do you get any sense out there, Sarah, covering these campaigns, that either campaign is willing to cede Iowa at this point, the Romney campaign, for instance?
Not at all. I think both campaigns are still very serious, working very hard here. You know, we're seeing a lot of ads on TV still. I don't think there's any indication that either campaign is backing off. That's just a few percentage points, and you're right. The recent polls have shown Obama picking up some ground, but you know there's still several weeks to go, and things can change, and they often shift quickly. So I don't think either campaign is letting up at all.
Iowa is so unique in many ways in the election, of course, the caucuses. But one unusual thing people may not know, Sarah, you can tell us about. Iowa's laws allow anyone who gets 100 signatures of 100 county voters to choose a specific voting place in that county. And that's unusual, isn't it?
Well, you know, I mean, there are, I think, 32 states that allow some form of early voting, but Iowa also has a system where satellites can be set up. So a lot of them won't be up and running yet tomorrow. Some will. For instance, in Iowa City, I know the library will have a satellite site, and on Friday there's a site at UNI, I believe. But throughout the state over the next several weeks, we'll be seeing more of these satellite sites opening up in all sorts of places. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's just, I think, an opportunity to reach out. My understanding is campaigns can ask for these sites and individuals can. So just one more way for voters to vote. In addition to, I mean, the big place to go tomorrow, if you want to vote tomorrow, is your county auditor's office. Those all open, I believe, at 8 o'clock. So.
Sarah McCammon of Iowa Public Radio, we appreciate you joining in our conversation here on Politics Day today, and we'll look forward to your further reporting. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
This is Politics Wednesday here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, and our analysts standing by listening to that conversation, Lindsay Kahn of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. A quick comment on that, the ground game, perhaps from you, Tim Hagel. I saw you listening intently there to Sarah's reporting. What jumps out at you about the competing campaigns' ground games?
Well, one thing I would make a distinction between the ground game, as it's more broadly defined, and early voting ground game. And Democrats have always led, they're much more organized in terms of focusing on that early voting aspect. And even there, you have to distinguish between early in-person voting. And as Sarah was indicating, you can do that in the auditor's office beginning tomorrow. Here in Iowa City, you can do it at the public library from, I think it's 10 to 9 p.m., and then they'll have other satellite locations later. And then there's the request for absentee ballots, which of course, go through the mail, and so the person gets the ballot at home, has to fill it out and send it back in. And so the Democrats have done a much better job over the years of focusing on that. With Republicans, they tend to have a set of voters that are more traditionalists and tend to like to come out on Election Day, but the Republicans have focused on trying to up their early voting numbers as well.
Mm-hmm. Would a strategy also be in getting, of course, the Democrats, while the poll numbers are in their favor, before something might happen, to get those votes in? Am I thinking correctly? You could have something happen in the world, in the country, that would
drastically change those poll numbers. So let's lasso those doggies in before they change their minds.
I always have to laugh at that because I always think of you know, vote early before something bad happens, right. You know, whichever campaign happens to be emphasizing it. But there is something to that. But, you know, it can work the other way, too, that if all of a sudden something happens really good for your candidate late in the game and the person's already voted for the other person, then you lose that vote. So, you know, there are pros and cons to that early voting.
Let's talk about the dueling bus tours that hit the road in Iowa this week, bringing attention to this year's judicial retention election. Justice David Wiggins, a part of the unanimous Iowa Supreme Court decision that paved the way for same-sex marriage in Iowa back in, what, April of 2009. He stands for retention this year. The same conservative group that waged a successful campaign to remove the three other justices involved in the case. They were removed by vote 2 years ago. They're campaigning for his defeat, Justice Wiggins' defeat. Bob Vanderplaats is president and CEO of the Family Leader. He says critics of the bus tour say it's unfair to judge a court or justice by one decision.
Let me tell you about one opinion. Dred Scott, one opinion. Blacks are property. Roe v. Wade, one opinion. The result, we have killed 60 million babies today. Varnum opinion, one opinion, and we're redefining the institution of marriage in the state of Iowa? Are you kidding me? And so the media elite says, you know, this is okay that they get to do this. It's okay they get to make law from the bench. It's okay they get to execute from the bench. It's okay they get to amend the Constitution from the bench. You know, this isn't just about marriage. It's about every one of your freedoms you hold dear. Because if they'll redefine the institution of marriage, they won't even blink an eye when they take away your private property, when they take away your guns, when they tell you how to educate your children, when they take away your religious liberty, or when they take away your freedom of the press.
Bob Vanderplaats, president and CEO of the Family Leader this week. Trailing behind the Family Leader bus, the Iowa State Bar Association. The lawyers say their tour in the heels of the Family Leader bus tour is an attempt to correct the record. Des Moines attorney Guy Cook says the Iowa Supreme Court did not redefine marriage or impose same-sex marriage through their decision.
The truth of the matter is it merely imposed the constitutional clause of equal protection. The Iowa Supreme Court was not activist. The truth of the matter is, they did not draft the legislation being challenged, nor file the lawsuit which came to them on appeal. No sacred traditions and rights are at risk. The truth of the matter is, only illegal and unconstitutional action to restrict or impede the rights of citizens under the Constitution reaches the court for a determination. Let me be clear. I do not suggest that Iowans cannot vote their choice in the retention election. Voters have the right to vote as they choose. I simply suggest that voters reflect on the wisdom of using the retention election as a referendum on a particular court decision and the impact that doing so would have on the future fairness and impartiality of Iowa's courts.
Des Moines attorney Guy Cook representing the Iowa State Bar Association in these dueling bus tours. Tim Hagel is one we've slated for analysis on our domestic and our Iowa front. How do you size this up, this campaign, compared to the one 2 years ago that successfully removed three justices?
Well, let me start by saying that I didn't think that the campaign 2 years ago was going to be successful just because it is so hard to remove any justice or judge when you're under the merit plan or the retention system that we have here in Iowa. And so it was very unusual that it was a successful campaign. I think this time, because now we're a couple of years further away from the decision, that perhaps some of the I guess maybe outrage is a good word for it, that was expressed earlier on in 2010 because it was closer to the decision, has probably faded a little bit, that we haven't seen major problems that occurred. So for the folks that hadn't already made up their decision pro or con on the actual issue, if they're sort of waiting to see, well, is it a problem or has it been a problem, that they may not see that there's been a great negative effect despite the arguments both ways.
Passion on both sides, or do you think it's only dissipated on the outrage side rather than the passionate joy that we also encountered when that decision was handed down?
Well, like I say, that really the key is going to be what the independent, the middle folks are going to feel about it. And if they don't see that there's been major problems, they may not, you know, care one way or another. And so that we're back to more the norm. And it probably is going to happen where Wiggins isn't going to get the usual 75% to 80% vote to retain, but maybe down in the 60s, maybe the 50s. But I think it would be very difficult to remove him, just as it always is.
So it's a simple majority that removes him?
Simple majority.
Oh, just over 51% would remove him.
Right.
Okay. I wonder if the job of removing Justice Wiggins is more complicated this time also, because juxtaposing with the 2010 campaign, given the fact he's the only judge up for retention who was involved in that decision. The other three justices, newly appointed, standing for retention, were not.
Right. And actually, oddly enough, I asked my students yesterday in my judicial process class how many judges they could name that were on the ballot this year out of some 70 that are there, and the only name they could say was Wiggins. Mm-hmm. And so to the extent that he's the one that's targeted, then certainly his name is out there. Now, that's not going to guarantee that the vote, they're going to vote one way or the other, but at least they know this person's name.
I wonder if this retention issue is likely to impact other races in the November election, the legislative races in Iowa, perhaps the presidential election. Always talk sometimes about energizing the base. Does it energize the GOP base to get out, increase the numbers of Republican voters going to the polls?
It does, and it actually it can help Romney, because to the extent that a lot of the social conservatives who care about this particular issue in Wiggins, that they may have had some reservations still about Romney, this may cause them to make sure that they get out if they're really interested in this as the gay marriage issue and removing Wiggins, and gets them to the polls, then that could very likely help Romney as well, because those are not going to be the folks that are going to be voting for Obama.
Have we noticed any legislative candidates, congressional candidates speaking to this issue, using it to their advantage?
I don't recall anything specific. It may have been in some of the House districts, State House and State Senate districts, but certainly not. I haven't seen it come up in the congressional campaigns.
Okay, join our conversation, Politics Wednesday. Tim Hagel with us, Lindsey Kahn with us. You can join our conversation about any of the topics we're talking about this hour. We'd like to have your questions, your comments as this race heats up. The first day of early voting here in Iowa begins tomorrow. The election 6 weeks away. 1-866-780-9100. River to river at iowapublicradio.org. Our email. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find us, Iowa Public Radio, on Facebook. Lindsey Kahn, let's turn to you now on the international front. Yesterday, President Barack Obama gave an annual address to the General Assembly of the United Nations. And in his address, President Obama mentioned Iran helping terrorist groups abroad, supporting the regime in Damascus, and its inability to show its nuclear program is peaceful.
Mm-hmm. So let me be clear. America wants to resolve this issue through diplomacy, and we believe that there is still time and space to do so. But that time is not unlimited. We respect the right of nations to access peaceful nuclear power. But one of the purposes of the United Nations is to see that we harness that power for peace. Make no mistake, a nuclear-armed Iran is not a challenge that can be contained. It would threaten the elimination of Israel, the security of Gulf nations, and the stability of the global economy. It risks triggering a nuclear arms race in the region and the unraveling of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That's why a coalition of countries is holding the Iranian government accountable. And that's why the United States will do what we must to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
President Obama yesterday at the UN. Lindsey Kahn, would it be fair to characterize this as a tightrope he was walking in references to Iran?
Oh, yes. I think that's a very fair characterization. He had to say that all options weren't, well, he didn't say all options are on the table, but he had to say that we will do whatever is necessary for the Israeli audience. And I don't mean that he needs Israeli support. What I mean is that he needs the Israelis not to do anything on their own. And if he took that option off the table, then they would feel that they had been backed into a corner.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. This was undoubtedly a speech, was it not, that was both to be consumed, had to be consumed by the international community and for domestic consumption, as this is an election year.
Yes, very much so.
What did you hear in the speech that told you that?
Well, There were a few things that he absolutely had to hit. Of course, he had to defend free speech. He had to do that. He had to condemn the violence at the same time. And he had to say that all options were on the table with Iran. Those things he could not leave out for his domestic audience and for, as I said, the Israelis as well. But he hit a few things that he needed to hit for the international audience as well. The speech was very complimentary and pro-UN, which is not something that most Americans care about, but it is something that many other countries care about. He specified that we want an independent Palestine. That's something that's very important for the international audience to hear. And a couple of other things. So you could tell very much that this was a speech that was intended to hit all major audiences, and that's difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. The address was just yesterday. Do we know what the reaction is internationally and domestically?
I've been looking at some of the international reaction, and it's interesting. You know, walking a tightrope is always a very dangerous thing to do, and of course, I think that his speech hit the things that it needed to do to shut down as much Romney criticism as possible. I mean, I don't think he gave Romney much traction. Romney's criticism, of course, has been weak leadership from the Obama administration, that it's been vague and unclear and weak. He can still claim that. I think that the sort of hardliner American population, the type that wants to see things responded to with immediate, swift, forceful justice, they're not going to like Obama no matter what he says. But Obama definitely very forcefully defended free speech, you know, was very unapologetic, to use the term that's been thrown around. That being said, the bits that were addressed to the international community, I think that's a little bit harder to do. Most of what he said probably comes out as rank hypocrisy to a lot of people in other countries, because I was looking at Al Jazeera, you know, the Qatar-based, usually Arabic language news network, but they have an English language broadcast, and there was a lot of commentary on there, and that, you know, everybody was saying, well, you know, he didn't talk about all of the things that America does that makes everyone angry. Well, of course not. You don't expect the president to get up and give a half hour long mea culpa on the UN stage, but a lot of people heard his speech and were thinking, but you do all these other things too. Why should we believe you? Why should we trust you?
Mm-hmm. How would you characterize, we have about a minute left, Lindsey Khan, the way the international community viewed then-candidate Obama 4 years ago? We remember the reception he had, for instance, in Berlin. What, 2 million people came out to see him. Compared to now, has he faded in the international's eyes?
Yes. The Pew Research Forum has done several international polls, and his popularity has dropped significantly pretty much everywhere. But it's still fairly decent for an American president. It's much higher than Bush's poll numbers. It's much higher than Romney, who is popular only in a couple of places. He has lost his sheen, definitely. And I think a lot of that has to do with some of his foreign policy actions, some of his, like, failing to close Guantanamo, that's a big deal for a lot of Europeans, for example. The drone attacks obviously make him unpopular in many Muslim-majority countries. So those are some of the things that I see as maybe causing a loss of popularity for him. But as I said, I mean, he's still more popular than many American presidents.
Lindsey Khan, assistant professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Glad to have her with us on this edition of Politics Wednesday. River to River, Tim Hagel with us of the University of Iowa. We hope you'll join our conversation as well. Tell us what's on your mind, your question, your comment, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. University of Northern Iowa, Lindsey Khan, did I misspeak there? We also will hear from an Urbandale newlywed whose nuptials earlier this month were thrown for a curve when the president showed up. That's toward the end of our program. Stay with us. Politics Wednesday on River to River. We are so glad to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer, and our analysts today on this Politics Wednesday, Lindsey Khan of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. As we do on Politics Wednesday, dissecting the latest developments, it is heating up. You would think it was a matter of days away from the election, November 6th, rather than a matter of weeks, 6 weeks. But early voting starting here in Iowa tomorrow, and by the end of the month, 30 states will be in the early voting process. We were talking about that in the early part of the program, the ground game. Sarah McCammon joined us to talk about that as well. Also, the vote, the thing that you will find on your ballot on November 6th, the judicial retention vote, the vote there. And we'd like to have you join our conversation on any of these topics. International topics also, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to Iowa City. Ryan, what do you want to talk about that we've touched on?
Yes, I'd like to go back to the judge retention issue, and I'd like to hear comments and feedback from the panelists about this, the vote and what happened in 2010. I would posit that there's a very small minority of people who oppose civil unions for gay couples, who want to outlaw all abortion in cases of rape or incest, who would deny a couple the right for in vitro fertilization. These social conservatives did come out and vote, but they also took strong advantage of the fact that typically in Iowa we have 26 or 27% no vote for judge retention, just quote-unquote contempt towards the court. Sorry, but it is a good pun. And I guess I'm wondering if now that people are more aware, I think a lot of people regretted that they voted against judge retention last time, not knowing the latitude of the issue.
Okay, let's get a reaction to that from Tim Hagel. Thank you, Ryan, in Iowa City.
Thank you.
Well, there are a couple of things about that. The first is that you were sort of touching on, in an indirect way, the idea that in a midterm election in 2010, you don't have quite the same number of people that come out as you do in a presidential election. And so the folks that vote in midterm elections do tend to be a little bit more partisan, I would say. The turnout for independent, no-party voters here in the state drops significantly in the midterm election. So that may make a difference this time around. In terms of sort of the collection of issues that you mentioned, probably, I wouldn't say that that's necessarily accurate in terms of what all of the social conservatives believe, but it's true that they were certainly motivated, but they alone couldn't have ousted those three justices. What had to also happen was a big push towards the concerns that, that many conservatives have of over-judicial activism, and that was the thing that helped to drive the three justices out of office.
Lindsay Kahn, I want to turn to you to finish up with a couple of items we didn't get to on the international front.
Sure.
We talked about President Obama speaking before the UN, Mitt Romney speaking about at the Clinton Global Initiative. Did we even get to that? I don't think so.
We did not. No.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about that. Romney spoke at the Clinton Global Initiative, their annual meeting in New York Tuesday, and in his speech he included remarks on Iran's nuclear ambitions and expressed concern over Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's comments on the elimination of Israel.
Today we face a world with unprecedented challenges and complexities. We should not forget and cannot forget that not far from here, a voice of unspeakable evil and hatred has spoken out, threatening Israel and the entire civilized world. But we come together knowing that the bitterness of hate is no match for the strength of love.
Okay. Lindsay Kahn, what did you hear there in his remarks?
I heard almost exactly the same thing that President Obama said, that that an Iranian nuclear weapon threatens the existence of Israel, which I think both candidates sort of have to talk about that. I'm not entirely convinced that an Iranian, a nuclear-armed Iran would, in fact, eliminate Israel. I think that that's speculative. But Romney is playing to the sort of the fears of many of his constituents that a nuclear-armed Iran is a crazy Iran, is a crazy Iran with a really big weapon that it would point at anyone it sort of felt like that day.
We have heard talk of the elimination of Israel, have we not?
Yes, but that doesn't mean that he means it. I mean, you don't seriously think that a politician means everything he says.
Well, those are very strong words.
Sure. President Ahmadinejad is in a very particular position. Iran has always wanted to play the sort of regional hegemon role in the Middle East, but Iran is Persian and Shiite. Most of the Middle East is Sunni and Arab, and he is not popular among Sunni Arabs, basically. He's not even very popular among Arab Shiites, but they at least have the religion in common. What he is doing with most of that rhetoric is trying to appeal to the one thing that he can to unite the Middle East behind him, to unite them behind him as a leader. That's the one thing that plays to everybody. Everybody likes hearing about, you know, no more Israel. Would they actually do it? I'm not entirely sure about that. I mean, the Arab world has tried a couple of times to do that, and it hasn't worked out very well for them. And Iran doesn't need a nuclear weapon to wipe out Israel. They have plenty of conventional weapons.
Tim Hagel, do you see it differently?
A couple of things, just real quickly. I think that Israel has a right to be concerned, and you indicate that they've tried it a couple of times. Well, maybe they're going to continue to try it until they succeed, in their view. And so it's something that I have to imagine that Israel doesn't want to take a chance on. On the other hand, in terms of the posturing that seems to be going on there, well, I suppose that we can look back to the posturing that Saddam Hussein did, where he was bragging at length about the possession of weapons of mass destruction, which in fact turned out to not be true, and even though we believe that he had them, and it ultimately resulted, of course, in his downfall.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Lindsey Kahn, if you could give us your ideas, if we can have any, about the a possible Obama second term in the Middle East versus a President Romney handling Middle East peace differently.
Sure. And let me be clear. I'm not saying that Israel has no need to be concerned. I'm absolutely not saying that. Of course, Israel has reason to be concerned. Of course, many of the states in the Middle East would like to get rid of Israel. I'm not trying to say that there's no concern. What I am saying is that the kind of rhetoric that implies that the minute Iran has its hands on a nuclear weapon, it's going to aim it at Israel and push the button is overplayed. And I agree with Tim. I mean, this is a regional politics issue. We have to keep that in mind. There is a lot of regional politics going on, and Iran has reason to want other states in the region to think that it has nuclear weapons and to have nuclear weapons in order to sort of play regional politics. That being said, okay, so Obama versus Romney in terms of Middle East foreign policy. I think the main difference is going to be that Romney has made very, very clear that he would sort of back the Israeli government in pretty much whatever it did. And that would depend on who was in the government in Israel, right? Not every Israeli government would behave the same way as a Netanyahu government. But the main point seems to be that Romney would not put any pressure on Israel to, say, withdraw from settlements, make any concessions to Palestinians, etc. Obama really, he's put some pressure on the Israelis. He obviously has not done enough for the American left wing. You know, he has been criticized heavily for not putting enough pressure on the Israelis. But he certainly resists some of the Netanyahu government's ideas about how to handle the peace process. But I think everyone's been sort of discouraged by the fact that there's been no progress, really.
Let's see if we can close the chapter on this anti-Islam film and the protests there. Libya's president told NBC News that that anti-Islam film produced in America that sparked violent protests in many countries had, quote, nothing to do with that deadly attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi earlier this month. Initially, the Obama administration said it had through Susan Rice, I believe. How has this thinking changed, Lindsey Kahn? It seems curious, doesn't it? Or is it logical?
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, there was speculation. There is no doubt in my mind that that attack was pre-planned. That attack was definitely carried out by a small group of people. We even know who they are. And there was speculation about that from international experts within hours of the attack. This was not something that came out weeks later. I mean, I'm on record having said it the day after.
We have days after Susan Rice saying that it was the result of spontaneous protests. Do we
yeah, that was confusing to me. I'm not entirely sure why the Obama administration said for several days that this was merely an outcome of the protest. I have the feeling that there was some confusion within the administration as to how to deal with this, because there were indications from both the president and the secretary of state that they blamed this on specific individuals. And then you had Susan Rice at the UN. So I think there was some confusion within the administration. But there seems to be absolutely no disagreement among experts on the region that this was a pre-planned attack. The one thing that we're not sure of is whether the protest itself was engineered in order to give cover to the attack, or whether the attackers simply used the opportunity of the protest to make their getaway easier.
Tim Hagel, one more point before we had a sort of a special ending. I wanted to play a conversation I had earlier this week. But before that, I would like to ask you about the impact of the video of Mitt Romney's comments on the 47% that they've had on this presidential contest. We have two fresh pieces of evidence that there has been an impact. And one of those is the brand new New York Times CBS Quinnipiac survey conducted right after the release of the video, showing Obama now leading Romney by 9 points among likely voters in Florida, 10 points in Ohio, 12 points in Pennsylvania, margins that we haven't seen before. What do you make of these latest numbers?
Well, my initial reaction is that they're probably outliers, that I can't see that big of a jump in that short of time. And one of the things that Republicans in particular have complained about is that the sampling has tended to oversample Democrats, which then, of course, would result in better numbers for Obama. You may have seen some movement. Maybe it's for the video. I don't think that the video is going to be that have that substantial of an effect, mainly because both sides have sort of used it to their advantage. It fits into the narrative for the Democrats and talking about that Romney's an elitist, not of touch, and so forth. And for Romney, it sort of brings out that issue of government dependence and need to shrink the size of government. So I think that on the whole, it'll probably get lost in the shuffle, even though we're still going to hear the 47% figure probably for the next 6 weeks.
Lindsey Kahn, I wonder if you quickly could point to what you would say are definitely turning points in this campaign so far.
Oh, dear. Well, I think the economy, you know, sadly, as it is for me, as somebody who cares about, you know, foreign policy and things, most Americans don't care very much about foreign policy. Most of them care mostly about the economy. So the fact that the economic data are sort of edging up right now is good news for President Obama. And this gets back to the early voting issue. The Democrats want as many people to vote while the economic data is good as possible. Just you mentioned the possibility of things going wrong. I think that would be a terrible blow for the Democratic campaign.
Mm-hmm.
As far as other, definitely the 47% video, the, you know, Romney's international visits where he made a couple of ill-advised comments, things like that. I think I would defer to Tim on this kind of thing.
Okay. Finally today, Lindsey and Tim, I'd like to share this with you and with Iowa Public Radio listeners. An Iowa couple had been planning their wedding for 6 months, and down to the last cupcake, they said, and it was to take place at a historic barn on Living History Farms in Urbandale. The date set, Saturday, September 1st. Little did these Urbandale residents, now newlyweds, John and Saley Gibbs, know the presidential campaign would be throwing a curve into their wedding. Earlier this week, I spoke with the groom, John Gibbs, and I began by asking him about the wedding plans they had made.
Sure. We had both decided that we wanted to have the wedding at a barn, and so we had been looking around in the area trying to find the right one, and we settled on Living History Farms. And so that was pretty much 6 months out from the day, and so we had a lot of planning around then, just trying to get the barn ready and try to just get everything ready to go.
Okay. Then came the complications. You had a September 1st wedding planned. When did you get the first word there may be complications?
Well, it wasn't until about a week out we were told that there was going to be, there was a possibility of someone coming, a VIP of sorts, and that's pretty much all we knew. We both kind of took a guess that mm-hmm. it would be a kind of a big deal, and we were starting to get a little worried. So
this was the word from Living History Farms, the people there.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But they didn't tell you who.
No, they didn't tell us who. We were just kind of throwing out guesses. They wouldn't let us know anything for sure.
Mm-hmm. Did you guess that it may be the president?
Yeah, Saley guessed it. Saley guessed it right away. So I thought it was a long shot, and I honestly didn't think it would be, but turns out it was.
Okay. So what time was your wedding planned for?
The wedding was not actually planned until 7. It was supposed to start at 7, so it was a later wedding. So we thought we might be okay there, but mm-hmm. we didn't really know how late the rally was going to be going.
Okay. In fact, when did the president speak there?
I believe he spoke around three or four, but they told us, once we did find out it was the president, they did tell us that he usually tended to go a little bit long, so that didn't help our anxiety by any means.
Okay, so the wedding day arrives. What happens?
The wedding day, you know, we're just busy doing, you know, photos, getting last-minute preparations set up, trying not to think about the rally. But I know Saley showed up. She had a hotel across the street from the barn where she was going to be getting ready. All of that was closed off. The parking lot was closed. Secret Service wouldn't allow anyone in. And so that definitely started to create some complications.
Uh-huh. So this means getting dressed, getting into your wedding finery, and and getting over there without a car?
Yeah. She actually had to be escorted over by the owner of the hotel. He had to convince the Secret Service to let them into the hotel. And then, from there, she and the rest of her wedding party and the photographer were basically locked down at the hotel until the wedding began.
Oh, my goodness. So everybody's – Saley has her wedding gown on, and the bridesmaids are there. And when did the lockdown get over so you could go move to the Living History Farms barn?
They let her out. It was a little after 5 o'clock. And by that time, they had allowed me onto the grounds with a couple other guys just to set up in the barn. We weren't even allowed to set up until 5 o'clock, so it was kind of a rush to get everything, all the decorations set up, everything in there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was definitely a little bit of a headache.
So your wedding went off as planned, or were there any hitches because of this?
Right before we started to walk down the aisle, there were still a few trucks beeping and moving things around, a few loud bangs, and so I kind of cut my eyes over towards Deb, and she went over and talked to the guys, and they ended up taking a break and during the ceremony. There were, no problems whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a, because of this coincidence, what will be your favorite memory?
Just the wedding in general was just great. I mean, we couldn't have asked for any better outcome. But obviously the gift that the president left us was definitely going to be the cherry on top.
Okay, so a gift arrived from the president. How long after the wedding was that?
It was just after the ceremony. Deb pulled us into a side room and told us that we had a gift, and we weren't sure what to expect, but she pulled out a bag, a little blue bag, and had the presidential seal on it, and so we were both pretty excited to open it up.
And what did you find when you opened it up?
Well, the first thing, there were two boxes, both also with presidential seal. One was a silver mint julep cup, and another was a serving tray, both with a presidential seal and his autograph engraved. And then my favorite part was there was a little note in there as well, handwritten by Obama to us, congratulating us on the wedding and wishing us luck.
Mm. How nice. What did you think? Yeah. What did you and Saley think, your wife think, when you saw that?
I think we were both kind of just in shock. I mean, the gifts in and of themselves were just great, but the note to me was that he took the time to write that out to us specifically was really special.
And it says?
Congratulations on the wedding. Michelle and I wish you a great life together. And then it's signed Barack Obama. And it's just a little presidential note card with a seal on it, and on the bottom it just says the president.
Maybe suitable for framing, huh?
Oh, I think absolutely. We've just got to find the right frame.
Did you and Saley write a note back?
We haven't yet. We definitely want to. Hopefully he would get it, or at least hear about it. But we're working on it. We just got to think of the right words.
Okay. I don't know if you and your wife are belong to a political party, but does the president have your vote this year?
We'll see. I mean, there's still some time to go. I'd like to hear what both of them have to say. It was definitely a great gesture. Hopefully it's not enough to necessarily sway my vote one way or the other, but I definitely appreciate it.
Right. How many media organizations have contacted you about this story?
Oh, my goodness. Too many. It's been all over the board. I mean, just from local news stations to, a lot of magazines, newspapers, Huffington Post was a big one, Inside Edition, CNN, all of the big corporations as well. It's been kind of a wild ride.
Well, John, we wish you and your new wife, Saley, a long and happy life. And thank you for telling us this fun story.
Yeah, thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
John Gibbs and Saley Gibbs, newlyweds from Urbandale.
Conversation I had earlier this week with John Gibbs. Just a few moments left. Tim Hagel, Lindsey Kahn. Lindsey, that would be a great some sort of a memory that would not be lost, would it?
Absolutely. That's fantastic.
I suppose it does give us an insight into campaign operatives that as an operative, you want to certainly do no harm. Imagine you're ruining someone's wedding and that splashing across front pages.
Yeah, that would be bad.
Okay. All fixed up by a silver platter engraved and a mint julep cup. Thank you, Tim Hagel, Lindsey Kahn, for joining us this hour on Politics Wednesday. We appreciate you being with us.
My pleasure.
River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Cedar Falls, help from Tony Daynor, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Jeff Schmidt. Theme music written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions. You can contact us anytime. Write us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.